You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 4th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road at the Monocle Cafe. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
The social contract between residents of major cities has all but shattered, as taxi drivers carry illegal firearms, and neighborhoods have created their own vigilante patrols. But it's not all doom and gloom, though. Young tech entrepreneurs have realized the awesome power of the internet.
Egyptian presidents, British media titans, and Canadian mayors. Today, I'm here with Jeffrey Kaufman and John Everard to look at leaders under fire. Then, on the anniversary of the US hostage crisis in Iran, we look at the symbolism of embassies.
I don't see under this current Iranian leadership any new kind of position for the former US embassy.
And we'll meet the authors of the forthcoming book, Tibet, An Unfinished Story, for coffee and conversation at the Monocle Cafe. All that, plus a trip to the World Travel Market and a bit of Nazi-looted art. That's Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck, right now. So, plenty coming up on the next hour here on Aperitivo, but before all of that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. The trial of the deposed Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has been adjourned after noisy scenes in the courtroom in Cairo. Mr. Morsi and his 14 co-defendants frequently interrupted the trial judge, rejecting the charges and claiming he is still Egypt's rightful ruler. It's reported at one point a fight broke out between defense lawyers and journalists. Mr. Morsi wore a suit instead of the white uniforms of his co-defendants. Throughout proceedings, he refused to recognize the court's legitimacy. The judge adjourned the trial until January the 8th, so lawyers can talk to their clients and sift through more than 5,000 pages of recently filed documents. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has been holding talks in Saudi Arabia, where he's emphasized the importance of the kingdom as an ally. Saudi Arabia has been frustrated with the lack of progress on the Syrian crisis. It believes Washington has been too weak in trying to end the bloodshed. A senior Saudi prince has warned the Secretary of State the kingdom could also shift away from the United States over Iran. Speaking in the capital, Riyadh, Mr. Kerry was keen to emphasize Washington's stance on Iran's nuclear ambitions.
Iran will not get a nuclear weapon. We are determined. President Obama has made that absolutely clear. And we need to work with our Saudi friends in an effort to try to deal with all of these issues. But right now we have some very important things to talk about to make certain that the Saudi Arabian U.S. relationship is on track, moving forward, and doing the things that we need to accomplish.
Saudi Arabia is rounding up thousands of illegal migrant workers after an amnesty introducing new employment rules expired. Nearly a million Bangladeshis, Indians, Filipinos, Nepalis, Pakistanis, and Yemenis are estimated to have left the country in the last 3 months. 4 million others obtained work permits before Sunday's deadline. Indonesian officials say 3,000 Indonesian illegal workers in Jeddah are in detention, awaiting deportation. Details have emerged of how 9 US skydivers and 2 pilots escaped as their planes crashed in midair on Saturday, turning one of the aircraft into a fireball. 4 skydivers were preparing to jump when their plane collided with another carrying 5 skydivers at 12,000 feet in the state of Wisconsin. All the skydivers safely jumped, one pilot ejected with a parachute, and the other safely landed the second plane. The Federal Aviation Administration has begun an investigation into the near tragedy. And in another lucky escape, a 19-year-old New York University student has been rescued after being trapped between 2 buildings in Manhattan. The student, whose name hasn't been released, was trapped in the narrow space between the university's dormitory and a parking garage next door. It took firefighters over an hour to break through the wall of the garage to free him. Investigators think the student may have fallen from a window or rooftop. Joseph Schirali, deputy chief of the New York Fire Department, says the student's expected to recover.
We were dispatched for a a victim that was stuck between two walls, between a parking garage and the multiple dwelling next door. He was removed alive. Again, it's undetermined how long he was in the shaft. It's undetermined how many stories he fell. And the extent of his injuries are unknown at this time. But he is conscious, he is alive, and he's being transported to the nearest hospital.
The new artistic director, Louis Vuitton, has been announced. Nicolas Ghesquière has been named in the past hour, confirming rumours he'd be appointed after Marc Jacobs stepped down from the role in October. The company said in a statement the designer would bring a modern creative vision to the house's women's collections. Mr. Ghesquière was creative director at Balenciaga until late last year. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Aperitivo, and the time here in London now is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Geoffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, and John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show.
Thank you.
Very nice to see you both. We're going to be dipping into quite a lot of things today, and I think we're going to start, actually, with what's been going on in Egypt, because the trial has begun today and then stopped straight away of Mohamed Morsi. The country's former president went on trial for inciting murder of protesters. But the trial was quickly adjourned and postponed until January after Morsi rejected the court's authority and called himself still the country's legitimate leader. This would be the second criminal trial of a former head of state in Egypt in less than 3 years. John, I wanted to pick up with you first of all and maybe just touch on your former ambassadorial role. When you're an ambassador sitting maybe in Cairo today watching what's unfolding in Egypt, especially with these kind of trials, what kind of missives do you send back to London? Do you try and just keep out of events as much as possible? Because there's no kind of fairness going to come out of this trial, is it? It's a terrible mess for all the observers and all the people who have been behind change in the country.
Sure. I mean, to answer your first question, no, absolutely don't try to interfere. This is an Egyptian matter. It'd be quite wrong for foreigners to stick their fingers in. What kind of message do you send back? I think the principal concern in London, in most Western capitals, would be, is this really a legal trial? I mean, has this man broken the law, in which case, you know, the trial becomes legitimate? Or is this simply another of Egypt's long political shows? And the moment, as you rightly hint, the omens are not encouraging. There's no real indication that the trial is going to be conducted to the legal standards that we've come to expect.
But, Geoffrey, do you think there will be any protest if there isn't fairness seen?
Oh, I think we've already seen, sorry to interrupt you, I think we've already seen protest, this famous now four-finger salute.
But I wonder, actually, I mean, protest from foreign governments at this point, because you just wonder whether everyone's going to go along with it.
Here's the problem. You have to work with the governments that you're given, and John's probably more qualified to speak on this than I am, but as a reporter who's covered Egypt and other uprisings and other countries, one of the... The reality is that Egypt has to resolve this. Unless you're prepared to go and invade again, which no one's talking about, Egypt has to resolve this. But let's face it, what's happening here and what makes me so uncomfortable as I watch the video today is that the future of democracy in the Arab world is very much on trial here. And when I was in Egypt this summer after the shootings of Morsi supporters, they looked at me and they said, ask America, you know, why we should ever believe in democracy after what you've done to us and allowed to happen here. And there, you know, there isn't an answer. There isn't a good answer. Yes, Morsi overstepped himself. Yes, he was moving in slightly uncomfortable directions that could have been dangerous directions. But let's face it, you know, Chavez has done this. Others have done this. Garcia in Ecuador. And we didn't sit back and let others throw them out.
Did people quickly bring John?
I mean, we didn't sit back and let others run around. There was a fairly determined attempt to throw Travis out not many years ago, and the coup failed, as we all know. But I didn't see many Americans rushing forward to stop it.
That was quite a long time ago. Let's face it. But nonetheless, I think that for the Arab world that's trying to build a new paradigm. Hmm. The overthrow of Morsi, duly elected, is a very difficult, it's a difficult equation.
The slight problem, though, is that although that may be morally correct, and there may be some people who said that to you in Cairo, whether for good or bad, there seem to be so many people who are actually glad that Morsi was kicked out. It's a very divided country, and there seems to be many people who are actually pro-democracy who are supporting actually a military coup in a kind of strange mental twist. Don't you think that's the real problem?
It's very much to me, when I was in Egypt this summer, it felt a little bit like being in Washington. People don't want to see the other guy win, and there's no sense of compromise. And Morsi was guilty of this too. Let's be clear, Morsi was not inclusive. He never reached out to his opponents or to the people who felt excluded.
Let's just take a little bit of a sound, actually, from Cairo today. Our correspondent Joseph Dana is there, and he filed this story earlier on.
Egypt's myriad of problems are ironically not unlike those facing the satirist Bassem Youssef, one of the most popular personalities in the Middle East. Youssef rose to stardom after the 2011 revolution, with fiery commentary on the state of Egypt's transformation from dictatorship to democracy, cut from the mold of Jon Stewart's Daily Show in the United States. With every new regime since the fall of Hosni Mubarak, Youssef, like the Egyptian people, faced new sets of problems over what can and can't be discussed openly in society. President Mohamed Morsi's regime put Youssef on trial, and the current military-backed government forced the comedian off the air just minutes before last Friday's show. After 2 years of political violence, Egyptian society is exhausted. Xenophobia against Palestinians, Westerners, and Syrians is rampant. The social contract between residents of major cities has all but shattered, as taxi drivers carry illegal firearms, and neighborhoods have created their own vigilante patrols. But it's not all doom and gloom, though. Young tech entrepreneurs have realized the awesome power of the internet to transmit Egypt's ongoing revolution. Tech companies are popping up throughout Cairo, with the promise of transforming the city into a regional hub of tech innovation. Egypt is embarking on what could be a pivotal and dangerous month. Many view the trial as a show, part of the military's campaign to root out the Muslim Brotherhood and crush the movement. The natural result, of course, is violence, but no one can be sure when it will return to the streets. Will it be this week or at the end of the month when Egypt holds a constitutional referendum? With U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry arriving in Cairo yesterday, all eyes remain on Egypt, and this November will be an important test for the new government. Bassem Youssef's popularity demonstrates exactly how important Egypt remains as the unofficial capital of the Middle East and the cradle of the ongoing revolutions which have irreversibly changed the region.
Well, lots of interesting points there. That's Joseph Dana, who's our Eastern Mediterranean correspondent, who actually sits most of the time in Istanbul. The point he was raising there, John, is that there's, as we touched at the top of the show, not only is democracy on trial there, but what happens in Egypt, it's a kind of template for whether we back other revolutions in the region. It's kind of, if it doesn't work there in this huge country, it seems that both America and the West are slightly hamstrung for what their diplomatic moves should be, don't you think?
Well, yes, to an extent. I mean, to the extent that we have, in any case, any great influence over what happens in places like Egypt. I mean, what is going on is Egyptian-driven. It's not that.
Well, we give them lots of money.
Well, a lot less now, it turns out. You were asking before about protests, and we're told that there's been a major suspension of American aid. So, yes, there's a financial lever, sure. But to what extent do we have any kind of freedom of action? I think the point you raise is very valid, that the tensions that we're talking about just now are very real. And we also have, in places like Syria, the added problem that although the West has made no secret of the fact that it would prefer to see Assad go, it's becoming clearer and clearer that the kind of forces that might replace Assad might make you look back on the Assad era as a kind of golden age. There's complications there too.
Jeffrey, John was saying it's not the role of the West want to intervene. You know, this is the job of, you know, our diplomatic corps and people to kind of stand back and leave this as an internal matter. But we have this kind of potentially this financial leverage. What's your take on that? Because, you know, actually, there are many times when things do happen in countries where we do dip in and actually have our two penneth worth about what should be done.
I think John makes a very important point. I think that the reality check of the last decade is that the U.S., NATO, the West just don't have the power they used to have. They, first of all, the world has changed. The expectation of international roles has changed. The expectation of empire has changed, and self-determination, the attitudes. But also the failure of the campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan have shown that you simply can't topple the dictator, plant the seeds of democracy, and watch the flowers grow. Absolutely. None of us believes that. And so there isn't the appetite to go into Syria. Libya was a limited war. It was successful, I think extremely successful in accomplishing its objective, which was unstated, which was to topple Gaddafi. But as we've seen, they've handed the people the country. I was there for most of 2011, and you felt the optimism. And of course, it's now been followed by regional mafias that have led to chaos. And so, you know, there isn't an easy solution. The Arab world is, I think, going to vex us for a generation or more until it can figure out what it wants in terms of government for the 21st century.
We're going to move on just in a second, John. But just one quick thing, you know, just returning to this point, you know, sure, we're not asking about sending troops in or sending people on the ground, but you just worry that there's not a clear opinion about what we think should happen. And without that, you can offer, you know, kind of no guidance to the region. And, you know, and if there's this kind of absenteeism, then you kind of wonder, you know, even in the story and what happens in Israel or somewhere where we are meant to be engaged diplomatically about the future of, you know, the Palestinians and the state of Israel. If that whole region, we say, actually, it's just too chaotic, we're going to stay away. Is that really an option now when we've been so involved in every decision up to here?
I think you're quite right. There's no question of sending in troops. I think we can rule that out straight away. I don't think that we've been quite as withdrawn as you've just hinted. I mean, we've made very clear from the outset that we, you know, how Egyptians, how Syrians, how whoever manages their affairs is for them. But we do look for basic democratic process, respect for human rights, and so on. It's process that we're focused on here, not necessarily the outcome. And, you know, who comes out of decent elections is the voters' decision, not the Western powers. The Egyptian example, of course, is extremely difficult in that context. You have an election which, by and large, was fair, produces a government that then goes and is not inclusive, as Jeffrey rightly says. And we've seen this violent revolt against it. And I don't think anybody's entirely sure where to go from here.
Well, we're going to look at another trial now, and one a little bit closer to home, because in the UK, the case against Rupert Murdoch's News of the World and the destruction of that tabloid in its wake continues. Press regulation, phone hacking, invasion of privacy, and the downfall of media executives have been splashed across the front pages for months. Jeffrey, we're seeing this trial of the key people from the News of the World. It's got people gripped. Every day there's more and more sensationalist headlines coming out that would have shocked even the readers of the News of the World back in its day. What are you making of the trial?
I think that there's a God. I think it's extraordinary to see Rebecca Brooks and Andy Coulson raked over their coals, having their personal lives exposed, being humiliated on the front page of the tabloids after having devoted their lives to doing this to others. I find it delicious. That, you know, I as a journalist, who believes in independence of media, I moving to the UK and seeing the excesses of tabloids in the name of journalism, which it's not. It's just pure prurient business. I think this is fascinating. Whether or not they're going to be found guilty or going to go to jail, I think some of them will. Some have already pled guilty. But it's great theater.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with all that. And I mean, I don't think my heart is skipping any beats as to what might happen to the unfortunate Rebecca. One thing that does worry me, though, is that it's become clear as these cases have unfolded just how far this had gone and how many people were involved. We're talking about industrial scale invasion of privacy. And it worries me that the damage this had done to the culture of British journalism will take a very, very long time now to repair.
I think to the political culture, when you see how Murdoch and his tabloids had both Labour and the Conservative Party in his palm, and the mere threat of defiance left you vulnerable to being destroyed by his tabloids. This wasn't just, you know, it's a mistake to think that these stories were just about selling more copies of the News of the World. They were about giving Murdoch absolute control over the levers of power in this country in an incredibly nefarious, insidious way. And
yes,
it worked.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the stuff coming out, you know, the threatening phone call to Gordon Brown about his sick son, the cirrhosis he had. An attempt to make sure that the paper gets the scoop rather than, you know, the father. It's stomach-churning stuff. There seems to be very little that these people would not do to advance their own interests.
You know, it's impossible to justify the need to invade these people's privacy on the industrial scale, as John said, that they did. I mean, we're all interested in gossip. We're all guilty of being voyeurs. We all want to know about what celebrities are doing. That doesn't mean we have a right to. And it certainly doesn't mean we have a right to hear their messages. It doesn't mean we have a right to hear Prince William or Prince Harry's messages left to their on their aides' cell phones, mobile phones. But these people thought they could get away with it, and they did for so long that they just got used to it and believed that even if they were caught, there would never be implications.
There's that extraordinary the Channel 4 tape of Murdoch saying, was it earlier this year, that this was just the culture of Fleet Street. The man has sort of internalized his own procedures and stopped believing he was doing anything wrong. That was chilling.
There was also a great story that came out, which is about, you know, David Blunkett being confronted with this evidence about his personal life by Coulson, yes. And you know, saying, you know, if I don't run it, somebody else will run it. You know, I'll do the kind of right thing for you. And then Blunkett ends up working for Murdoch, you know, later on. It shows what the power balance was at that time, that, you know, you knew you were going to get done over, but you would still acquiesce in it.
And the interesting thing about Blunkett in that case is that he was single, having a relationship with a woman. There was nothing nothing illicit. There was nothing wrong. He was a man having a relationship with a woman. End of story. And he said to Coulson, what, can I not have a private life? And Coulson's rationale was, as you say, well, if we don't run it, someone else will, which was absolute horse feathers, to put it politely.
Yes.
Now we're going to quickly have a little listen to something and a different story now. This is, we're going to Toronto, where the mayor of Toronto is I've been told that the clip's gone. We're not going to listen to it. So Rob Ford, everyone will probably know now, is the mayor of Toronto, and he is accused of smoking crack, among many other potential sins. And the police now say they have a film which allegedly shows him doing this. He was caught today phoning into a radio show, pretending to be somebody else, defending himself, and then his voice kind of couldn't hold out for long enough, and everyone guessed who it was. Why do some people just get away with this and some people not? In a way, he has got away with it. He's been in power for so long, and there seems to be, he's a bit of a Berlusconi where, you know, even no matter how much mud is thrown at him, he seems to somehow get away with it. John, what do you think about his image, reputation?
Firstly, I think this is such a great story. I mean, the drunkenness in public places, being filmed with a crack pipe, phoning into a radio show, you couldn't make it up. And yes, I think there's a certain amount of Berlusconi about this. I think the guy just, you know, convinced himself he couldn't be touched. But I think that mud is now sticking. I don't think it's going to be taken seriously as a politician for very much longer.
Jeffrey, why do some people have to resign and some people stay?
I have to declare myself. I grew up in Toronto, and when it was called Toronto the Good, when Peter Ustinov called it New York run by the Swiss, and now New York run by a crack addict. This is interesting, but I think there's also a parallel with what we were just talking about Rebecca Brooks and Andy Coulson. And I think what's very, I've watched the Ford story very closely because it is my hometown. And the chief of police of Toronto was the one who held a news conference late last week to say that they found erased on a hard drive of a disposed computer this mobile phone video of that the Toronto Star and Gawker had talked about last spring, and Ford said didn't exist, and he said we found that it does exist. And that's where why Ford is back in hot water in a very serious way. But what this does, and I think it compares to Brooks and Coulson and the Murdoch story here in London, is we're seeing people who in previous generations would have gotten away with these things being held to account. And I find that part of these stories very inspiring, that people in power now are like the rest of us. And when they cross the line, they are in danger of being held to account. And that's what Ford is facing. Now, they can't throw him out. The laws in Toronto, which is a creature of the province, require that he be convicted before he resign, before he be thrown out. He has said he won't go. It's a year before the election. So the city's in a kind of suspended animation. The hope is that he'll be hounded out. And he's lost virtually all of his support.
Okay, we're going to have to pause, I'm afraid, there for 1 second, because we need to have a couple of promos before we conclude the show.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Geoffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, and veteran diplomat John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay. We're going to quickly try and look at two stories. Firstly, local elections in the United States. The big one to look out for is New York. John, I know this is something that's been intriguing you. Why is it important? Oh, sorry, Geoffrey, I know this would be you, apologies.
Well, actually, I think we do know that Bill de Blasio, the very, very liberal candidate who no one thought was in the running, will win in New York, and that's fascinating. But I think there are two governor's races that are also very interesting, because Chris Christie, the centrist Republican, is going to win tomorrow in New Jersey, and Terry McAuliffe, the unpopular Democrat, former fundraiser party bagman, is going to win significantly in Virginia. And what's interesting is you have a Republican Party on trial in these two state governorships. You have Ken Cuccinelli, a fervent Tea Party Republican in Virginia, who is who follows the party line 100%. And they don't like him in Virginia. And then you have a Republican in Chris Christie, who is a compromiser who, as you remember, in Hurricane Sandy, got pilloried for hugging Barack Obama and saying he was his kind of guy. And he's going to win. So this is very much Republicans, are you paying attention? This, you know, your purest Tea Party guy is going to be trounced. The man who can compromise is going to win. Will there be a bigger lesson here? That's why this is so interesting.
So, Geoffrey, for you, this is a straight kind of poll on whether the shutdown was as bad as we imagined, do you think, for the Republicans?
Well, I think it's a poll on the future of the Republican Party, and will they listen? There's no evidence that the hardliners in the Republican Party will learn anything from this. But clearly, for those who watch, that is what to look at.
Yes, absolutely. I think that any sane Republican now will be watching these results very, very carefully. You talk about the future of the Republican Party. I mean, I think it's now an open question just how much of a future there is. Having lost the popular vote, 5 out of the last 6 elections, and having sort of performed a stunt like we've seen this year, are they actually on the way to electoral obscurity?
And I just want to make one more. I know you want to move on, but one point about Chris Christie. Chris Christie is clearly one of the Republican front runners for 2016, if Hillary Clinton or whoever runs for the Democrats. The question is whether the Republican Party, in its primary form, when the party itself selects a leader, would support someone as moderate, as compromising, in I say that in the positive sense, as Christie, or whether a hardliner who they love will get elected and lead them to defeat again.
Now, I've literally got chance for like a 30-second soundbite almost. But, John, I'll give this one to you. It's 1979 today was the anniversary of the siege of the US embassy in Tehran. Again, huge demonstrations, again, even now happening in Iran, despite the move to a more kind of moderate presidency. When you look at embassies around the world, and you've been sat in many yourself, how symbolic do you think the people in the country see the embassy? The siege, the seizing of an embassy still seems to kind of say so much about kind of seizing the kind of power away from another country.
Well, yes, absolutely. Embassies still in a lot of parts of the world have this sort of deep symbolism, not just seizing embassies, but demonstrating outside embassies a favourite pastime, particularly in places like Latin America. And Latin Americans often get very cross when they discover that the country they want to demonstrate against doesn't have an embassy in their country. which causes gnashing of teeth. But the seizure of the American embassy in 1979 was fascinating. Firstly, it takes a wrench now to remember that it was touch and go whether the students would seize the American embassy or the Soviet embassy. And had the vote within the Students' Union gone the other way and they marched into the Soviet embassy, I mean, you can imagine just how different history might have been. Also, the way that this seizure polarized Iranian opinion. The fracture between Iran and the United States really started at that point. Again, it takes a wrench to remember that Jimmy Carter's first reaction to the seizure wasn't to slam down on Iran. It was just to ask for the hostages to be released on humanitarian grounds and for Iran and the United States to enter into a strategic alliance against the godless Soviet Union. Now, at the time, that might also have worked. You look like it's time's up.
I think it's time up, but I was just going to say it is extraordinary that even now it's such a kind of a contentious issue, and it's something that, you know, on both sides can still bring people out onto the street. But we are going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Jeffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, and John Everard, the former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's aperitivo. We'll head to the Monocle Cafe to talk to Bette. We're going to talk about looted Nazi art, and we'll also be at the World Travel Market in London. But first, we're going to have in a moment Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich,
Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
So first of all, here's Bill Bingham with the news headlines.
The trial of the deposed Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi has been adjourned after noisy scenes in the courtroom in Cairo. Mr. Morsi and his 14 co-defendants frequently interrupted the trial judge, rejecting the charges and claiming he is still Egypt's rightful ruler. US Secretary of State John Kerry has been holding talks in Saudi Arabia, where he's emphasised the importance of the kingdom as an ally. Saudi Arabia has been frustrated with the lack of progress on the Syrian crisis and believes Washington has been too weak in trying to end the bloodshed. Saudi Arabia is rounding up thousands of illegal migrant workers after an amnesty introducing new employment rules expired. Nearly a million Bangladeshis, Indians, Filipinos, Nepalis, Pakistanis and Yemenis are estimated to have left the country in the last 3 months. Indonesian officials say 3,000 Indonesian illegal workers in Jeddah are in detention awaiting deportation. Details have emerged of how 9 US skydivers and 2 pilots escaped as their planes crashed in mid-air on Saturday, turning one of the aircraft into a fireball. 4 skydivers were preparing to jump when their plane collided with another carrying 5 skydivers at 12,000 feet in the state of Wisconsin. All the skydivers safely jumped. One pilot ejected with a parachute and the other safely landed the second plane. And in another lucky escape, a 19-year-old New York University student has been rescued after being trapped between 2 buildings in Manhattan. The student, whose name hasn't been released, was trapped in the narrow space between the university's dormitory and a parking garage next door. It's not thought he's seriously injured. The new artistic director at Louis Vuitton has been announced. Nicolas Ghesquière has been appointed, confirming rumours he'd take over after Marc Jacobs stepped down from the role in October. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Bill. And Bill was telling you the story there about the parachutists and about their lucky escape. I chopped a bit out of the script earlier on, so he had about 10 seconds to get in. He was like an elegant parachutist getting in through the door and into that seat in 5 seconds without any flap whatsoever. So thank you very much, Bill. And he's going to be back in another 26 minutes with a calm, full reading of the world news headlines. But anyway, welcome back to Aperitivo, live on Monocle 24. And the time now is 18.34 here in London and 14.34 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to head to the Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street for a bit of coffee and plenty of conversation. On today's show, we're going to hear about Tibet, a corner of the world that falls often into a geographical category, along with places like Zanzibar and Timbuktu. The myth of Tibet in international diplomacy has far exceeded a deep and practical understanding of the regional geopolitics. In their new book, Tibet, An Unfinished Story, Leslie and Stefan Halper, both of Cambridge University, outline the origins of this enduring myth from the post-World War II years through to the Cold War. Leslie and Stefan are now joined at the Monocle Cafe with our very own Alid John. Alid, over to you.
Thank you very much, and you indeed. I am joined now by Leslie and Stefan Halper, co-authors of Tibet, An Unfinished Story. Thank you very much for joining us, guys. Why is this story unfinished, and what is yet to come?
Well, the story is unfinished because the Chinese occupation of Tibet is meeting a great deal of resistance on the ground, and the efforts to extinguish Tibetan culture and to remove the Dalai Lama from the lives of his people is a very powerful effort on the part of Beijing, but it isn't working. And as a result, you look at the longevity of the Tibetan people and their culture, compare it to the Communist Party in Beijing, and you have to wonder which of the two is going to last longer.
So what aspects specifically of Tibet's culture do you see as enduring beyond that of China's? I don't want to pitch this as a China versus Tibet discussion specifically, but I'm interested to know that the case you've made for Tibet must depend on some statistics or some facts.
Well, I think what the Tibetans would like to see is a measure of autonomy. At this point, they're not allowed to practice their religion. The culture is being systematically deconstructed in that the jobs are going to the Han Chinese. The children would like to be able to learn Tibetan as their first language. I think what they're looking for is a sense of autonomy. I agree with what your question was. It might be very hard at this point for them to get or gain independence. The Dalai Lama is quite elderly and will pass away soon, which poses another host of issues and problems. Who will take over and who will lead the Tibetans in their struggle?
It's a story which you both have a lot vested in and something which you spend a lot of time on. Why did he choose to write the book?
What a great question. I suppose that whenever the topic of Tibet comes up, people wonder, whatever happened to Tibet's bid for independence? Why did Tibet fail to become an independent nation when so many other countries coming out of, you know, the Second World War and coming out of the collapse of communism managed to do it? I mean, look at, you know, Hungary, Ukraine, Nepal, so on and so forth. So we were really curious about this, and we looked into it, and what we found was that there were two real stories about Tibet. One was the fact that Tibet, a small, inexperienced, naive country, without even a foreign service, you know, no diplomatic service, had no idea of how to negotiate these vigorous currents in the Cold War period, and failed to position themselves properly between China and India, Britain and the United States. So they lost that part of it. But the myth of Tibet has gone on. The story of Tibet as one of the great Western imaginaries has continued. And as a result of that, you have a tremendous global following of the Tibetan story, which is the oldest myth in the West. You know, it started with Herodotus in 500 BC. He discovered gold-digging ants, which we talk about in our book. And you see all of these things unfolding over time. Major Francis Young Husband, British great game soldier, was the first to actually get to Lhasa. We talk a lot about his difficulties in the high Himalaya. One soldier put his false teeth in a glass of water overnight, and when he woke up, he said it looked like quail and aspic because they were frozen solid. You know, writers who were with the expedition, the ink froze in their pens. So this was a very tough thing, but the British got to Lhasa and it opened up, but the stories came back to London. the drawing rooms of London, the high tables of Oxford and Cambridge, were full of stories about the adventure that was possible in Tibet. And it was, you know, it wasn't just any place. It was the place to go if you were looking for adventure and self-realization. So that myth has lived on. And the terrible treatment of the Tibetans by the Chinese is a source of great dismay for populations around the world. And it's a kind of soft power that Tibet exercises. It's the power of moral condemnation of China's civil society. And people ask the question, what kind of country could be doing this? And do we really want these people running the World Bank and the IMF and other global institutions? And of course, the answer is, thanks very much, but not this week.
Touching on your first point there, the fact that Tibet was on the receiving end of such terrible treatment. They went through a period of what is termed in your book as a kind of diplomatic naivety on the world stage. Yeah. In the wake of the Cold War, there were events taking place which they did not know how to navigate. Do you put the fault then of Tibet's situation on the broader global community for not lending a hand?
We talk a lot in the book about the efforts the Tibetans made to find a way forward and the treachery they had to deal with Indian Prime Minister Nehru, whose principal worry was this 2,000-mile border that he shared with China. And he was concerned about the Chinese coming over the border, and he made every effort to bow to Chinese demands, which included that India accept China's control of Tibet. So Tibet was caught in the China-India dimension. It was caught by Britain's withdrawal from the region after World War II because it was financially bankrupt. It was caught because the United States was, first of all, so far away, was relying on India for stability in South Asia, but couldn't rely very heavily because India was itself compromised. So here was poor Tibet looking for support, but all of the major players were compromised. And in our book, we discuss very, you know, personal kind of stories about national leaders who were trying, who were involved in this.
I wonder if we could talk a moment about the process of the research that you've had to undergo. Some of these, the research you went through was to go through CIA files, declassified, and Chinese declassified files. What was it like getting your hands on that kind of material for the two of you who are both involved in the debate?
Today, almost 60 years later, these documents are still classified. And in some way, it's perhaps that the United States government, where we tried to get a lot of the material, is still worried about their relationship with the Chinese and the Dalai Lama. It's a very sensitive issue. In terms of the archival material that we found in the Chinese Foreign Ministry, that was very difficult. We were there, and I went every single day to the archives and would request hundreds of documents and then come back the next morning, and they would say, no, you can't have these.
As Leslie says, we got about 1,000 documents from the Chinese Foreign Ministry. Some of those things, they really didn't know what they were giving us. I mean, we had information about Mao Zedong's collusion with Stalin about the invasion of Tibet. Stalin provided the aircraft that supported the People's Liberation Army when they came across the Tibetan border. They didn't know they were giving us that information or all of the efforts that Mao made in Moscow. This was really a 10-year effort of collection of a lot of disparate pieces of information and putting it together in one story.
Unfinished story, but one that needs to be told, of course. Stefan and Leslie Harper, thank you very much indeed. Andrew, back to you in the studio.
Thank you very much, Aled. And can you bring me back a flat white when you come as well? Thank you. That was Aled John speaking with Leslie and Stefan Halper, authors of the forthcoming book, Tibet, An Unfinished Story. Up next, a priceless hoard of modern art found in a cluttered German apartment. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, it's a story that's almost unbelievable. A hidden treasure trove of artwork valued at nearly $1.4 billion discovered in a small cluttered flat in Munich. The German magazine Focus broke the story yesterday. A collection of hundreds of pieces were uncovered in a raid, from Matisse and Picasso to Max Beckmann and Franz Marc. Artwork said to have once been confiscated by the Nazis or purchased from those fleeing the country during the outbreak of the Second World War. The pieces were uncovered in 2011, but the news has only just broken now. The owner of the flat was the son of an art dealer who had been authorised by Goebbels himself to sell pieces that had been seized by the Nazi party. Well, joining me now is Anne Weber, co-chair and commission for the looted art in Europe, and also director of the Central Registry of Looted Cultural Property. Anne, could you tell me how important is this seizure?
It's very important. I mean, we don't, of course, yet know quite how many of these works are looted and confiscated. But it's very important that it's been found and that it represents very much a tip of the iceberg of what was still in Nazi hands, if you like, at the end of the war and remained in the hands of people who were dealers and who then disposed of it over the decades. I think it's almost like a snapshot out of time, this collection, because Görlitz himself, the father of the man who in whose flat this was found, died in 1956. So over the succeeding decades, he would have had time to dispose of it, as many other Nazi dealers did, particularly in Munich. There was a network of Nazi dealers.
And do we have any understanding of why it's taken so long for this story to come out?
Well, that's as important a story, I think, as the find of the collection itself. One has to ask why the Bavarian authorities have not released information about this. They still haven't released information. This was broken by a journalist, and they've been very reluctant to talk about it. It is 2.5 years since they found this art, and it means a lot if it is looted, and some of it appears to be. It means a lot to the families from whom it was taken, and they've been waiting 70 years to find their looted property, and there's no reason why they should have to wait another 2.5 years and even longer, perhaps.
Now, the finding work such as this is, you know, a part of your work. How common is it for pieces at this point to still turn up?
They turn up for sale all the time, and very often they come from people who've had them in their families for 50, 60 years. We found some paintings recently at auction in Austria, which had come from a family that acquired them in 1941 at a looted sale, at a forced sale. So, obviously what we'd like to know about that particular family is what else they acquired at that sale, because there were 200 works from the family there. But it's exactly as we might have thought, that as the generations go on, perhaps the next generation or two generations down, they don't know what is on their walls or what they've inherited. And so they come to the market. But what is interesting, particularly interesting about this case, is that one of the works, although the story says that the Bavarian authorities seized everything 2.5 years ago, one of these paintings was put up for sale last year at a leading German auction house by Cornelius Görlitz, the man in whose apartment they were found. And it was a looted painting. It is a looted painting. So one would like to know what else he has and how he was able to do that.
So this obviously puts a spotlight on many of the German auction houses, but do you think that's the same problem for all auction houses? Are they very good at checking, you know, where art has come from? Because I guess that many of the pieces that were from this period, if people know that they've come from Germany or they've come from Austria, you would hope that they would begin to check, you know, the credibility of them before they were sold.
Virtually no auction house, apart from Sotheby's and Christie's and a couple of others, check what they're selling with any real focus. And in Germany in particular, there was a case just a few weeks ago of another leading auction house where two looted works of art turned up for sale. And the consignor, the seller, refused to do anything about it. And so the auction house simply sent them back to him rather than making sure that they went, you know, that some settlement was reached. It's a big issue in Germany. The auction houses are always selling. A lot of looted works of art come up for sale there. And there needs to be much greater regulation of the art market and also a much greater sense of code of ethics amongst German art dealers about all this.
And just tell me, you know, if somebody has registered that a piece of art was stolen from their family back in the 40s or even in the 30s, and then a piece appears, how easy is it to tie up the owner with the artwork? Does it normally still involve a court case? Is there still many hurdles for a family to get over before they get the artwork back?
There are many hurdles, but in fact, the law is of no help in virtually every country, because all these cases are out of time legally. The statute of limitations has run. So it's really only through moral discuss, you know, a moral issue that one can do anything about it. And it's, you know, unfortunately, because the art market has freely sold looted art over the last 50 years or so, there are a lot of innocent purchasers out there who bought works in good faith. And so when they come to sell them, that's when they often are discovered. And what we try to do, we represent many families. We also work with people who are innocent victims. And we try to ensure that we don't have another two sets of victims, that there is a resolution which is an equitable resolution, a fair resolution for all parties.
Do most people, though, if they've had art looted from them, I think what you're implying is in some cases the art may get sold or there's a cash settlement or something. But do most people want those paintings back? And does it mean a huge amount to somebody whose family may have been, you know, destroyed during the war if that artwork does return to them?
Yeah, that's a very important question. It means a huge amount to families. We've been inundated today and last night with emails from all over the world, from people desperate saying, do you think, you know, my father's painting might be amongst these? Do you think my mother's painting might be there? Do you think my grandfather's painting? There's a real sense of hope that something that, because these were taken from people in the most terrible of circumstances, their lives were absolutely ruptured and destroyed. The life that they had was destroyed, even if sometimes the particular lives were destroyed as well. So it means a huge amount. It's not, people talk about that they're worth, nobody knows what these paintings are worth. They say they're worth 1 point something billion. But actually the value to the families is an emotional value, and it's beyond calculation, financial calculation.
And just finally, the registry of looted cultural property, is that something that has, you know, a set number of items on it at the moment? Do you know that you've got, you know, several thousand items there? And we don't know, of course, many of these items may have been destroyed. We don't know whether they survived the war. But how many, can you give us some idea of the scope of what you're still searching for?
Yeah, so I can tell you that as far as the cases that we have scores and scores of cases, and they range from maybe, you know, 20 paintings to 500 in a collection to more. 90% of those, despite expert research, you know, painstaking research, 90% of those works are still missing. And that is the same for other people we talk to who do this work. So that's why this case is so important, because to find 1,500 works, of course, is a huge amount. But we also know that museums have a lot of them. In Germany, the German culture minister has already said that they're full of thousands and thousands of looted works that have not been identified or returned, and that until that happens, Germany can't draw a line under this issue.
Amazing. Well, Anne, thank you very much for taking time on a very busy day to come in and see us. That was Anne Weber, co-chair for the Commission for Looted Art in Europe, on the recent discovery of a whole cache of paintings in Munich. Thank you very much. Now, Europe was immensely affected by the recession and Portugal was hit hard by it. But there's one industry that prospered during this period, and that's the tourism sector. Visitors to Portugal went up and they're spending more than ever before. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco toured the world travel market in London today and met up with Adolfo Mesquita Nunes, Portugal's Secretary of State for Tourism. Among other things they discussed was Portugal's successful tourism industry and how they're promoting their country in other Lusophone nations.
Tourism in Portugal didn't stop growing during the last years, and although we are probably in one of the best years ever, the last 2 years were also a year of growing. The difference between this year and the years before is that not only we are growing in tourists, in receipts, but we are also growing in the profits from the hotels, which are finally getting in an up route again.
What are your biggest markets in terms of tourism in Portugal?
United Kingdom is our biggest market, so that's where we are. United Kingdom, Spain, France, Brazil, and Germany are our main markets. So European and Brazil.
What about all the Lusophone countries? Do you have kind of a special marketing strategy in those countries? Like not only Brazil, but, you know, Angola as well. And
I usually say that Brazil is our China. I mean, it's our treasure. It's one of the markets that is growing more and with more capacity of growing. And the Brazilians are people who spend a lot in Portugal. So it's good not only for the hotels, but also for the economy. We have a record of profits from tourism this year, and Brazilians are contributing a lot. So we have a special marketing for Brazilians and for Brazil because we want to grow. And it's also important because Lisbon is a hub for the Lusophone countries. So it's also important for the other European countries to look for Portugal as a hub for Africa and Brazil.
Portugal is a relatively small country, but you do incredibly well in terms of soft power. And I mean, when people think about Portugal, I think they associate with positive things. Why is that? What do you think?
Because we are positive. I mean, in what concerns tourism, we are surely in the first group of countries. We have 14 million tourists per year. We are one of the 20 most competitive countries in the world for tourism. So tourism is a good image of Portugal and a good image of what Portuguese can do and their capacity. And yes, I agree with you that there is no single tourist that when leaves doesn't mention the fact that people are welcoming and that we have a bright side to offer.
And what next? Do you already have plans for 2014? Do you think the success will continue or do you see some problems ahead?
We are positively sure that this success is to continue. We are growing in a consistent way since 2010. So this is not just something that happened by hazard. It's something that is planned as a strategy. We want to reinforce our statute of a huge country in what concerns tourism. So we are making serious efforts to be more competitive, to give to the companies and to the hotels better conditions to keep fighting and keep growing and to keep their sense of competitiveness. And we are being finally recognized by the market. We have received several awards this year, 9 European awards, and we are nominated for 12 World Travel Awards. So I think that we are in a good shape.
In terms of attraction, what do you think really attracts tourists? I know it's quite varied. You have cities like Lisbon, but you have an amazing beachside. But is there a specific area that has been growing a lot in recent years?
Well, it depends on the market you are talking to, because different markets want different things. So if you are talking about the United Kingdom, probably what most attracts is the sun and sea. But if you talk with Brazilians or with the Chinese, what attracts is the history, it's the fashion, it's the fact that we are a European, new, luxurious country. So what I would say to answer your question is what we have best is the diversity concentrated in such a small piece of land. So we have everything that can attract the tourists, almost 9 centuries of history, sun and sea, climate, people, music, diversity concentrated in such a small piece of land.
Well, that was Portugal's Secretary of State for Tourism, Adolfo Mesquita Nunes, with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And now in the studio is Daphne Denis, who's come in to tell us what's going to be heading up the shows later tonight, The Globist Asia and also The Daily.
Yes,
tell me what your lead stories are going to be.
The lead for The Globalist Asia is going to be about Pervez Musharraf being granted bail in Pakistan. So that means that he's going to be able to walk out of his house for the first time since he went back.
Well, that's one presidential trial fewer that we can look forward to over the coming days.
And then on The Daily, we'll just be talking politics and elections. We will head to Virginia to talk about how the vote there, the governor's vote there, will reflect just generally what the country feels about Obama.
Well, that's good, because then we'll have the US elections covered, because we were talking about the Bill de Blasio in New York a little bit earlier. Well, Daphne, thank you very much. I know you've got lots to do, and so have I, because I've got to wrap this show up, because that's all we have time for on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Geoffrey Kaufman, London correspondent for ABC News, and John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, research by Maddie Araujo, And our studio manager was Jack Phillips. Next up is Culture with Robert Bound, who will be finding out how to design a building for an auctioneer when he takes a tour of the new London headquarters of Bonhams. This show is going to be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Aperitivo, it's time to say goodbye. And thank you very much for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists across seven disciplines and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. For Rolex, it's a chance to ensure the world's artistic legacy is passed on to the next generation. One year can inspire a lifetime.